Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. This program is being held in association with the Harvard Business School Alumni Association. Tonight's program will feature Susie Welch, author of the new book, 10-10-10, A Life-Transforming Idea, and she will be in conversation with her husband, Jack Welch, business commentator and former CEO of General Electric. So before I turn the program over to Jack Welch and Susie, let me tell you a little bit more at this time about both of them. Susie Welch is a noted columnist for O, the Oprah magazine, where she writes frequently about balancing work and life, as well as the delicate art of managing career challenges. She is also an executive in residence at Babson College's Center for Women's Leadership, where she works with undergraduates and MBAs. Susie was born in Portland, Oregon, and received her BA from Harvard College in 1981. She then joined the Miami Herald as a reporter. She left her job as a journalist to attend Harvard Business School, where she graduated as a Baker Scholar in 1988. After Harvard Business School, Susie worked as a management consultant specializing in strategy and manufacturing. She joined the Harvard Business Review as a senior editor in 1995 and was named editor-in-chief in 2001. During her tenure there, Susie was the author of numerous articles on leadership, creativity, and organizational behavior, as well as a contributor to several books on management. And it was while she was editor that she met Jack Welch. And the rest, as they say, is history. She is the mother of four children and is actively involved with several nonprofit boards. Jack Welch is currently the head of Jack Welch, LLC. He serves as a partner with the private equity firm of Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, and is also a consultant to Interactive Corporation. Jack is a contributor on a variety of television network business shows and speaks to business audiences and students around the world. Jack also teaches leadership course at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Jack was born in Salem, Massachusetts, and received his undergraduate degree from the University of Massachusetts and an MS and PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois. He began his career at General Electric in 1960, and in 1981, he became the company's eighth chairman and CEO. Now, this is amazing. During his 20-plus year tenure as CEO, GE's market cap rose from $13 billion to $400 billion. Revenues grew from $27 billion to $125 billion, and earnings grew tenfold to almost $14 billion. In 2000, he was named Manager of the Century by Fortune magazine. Jack and Susie co-write a widely read column entitled The Welch Way. This column appears in Business Week magazine. It's published by the New York Times and is syndicated in more than 45 major newspapers around the globe. Jack and Susie are also the co-authors of Winning, a number one Wall Street Journal and international bestseller. In 2001, Jack wrote his number one best-selling autobiography, Jack, Straight from the Gut. Jack is the father of four as well, and is an avid Boston Red Sox fan. And now I invite you to sit back, relax, and listen carefully while Jack Welch, in conversation with Susie Welch, discusses her new book, 10-10-10, The Straightforward Lessons of Problem Solving and Their Consequences. Susie will make some remarks to start things off. So please welcome, give a really warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Susie and Jack Welch.
Thank you very, very much. I'm Susie Welch. I like the way you put my bio where you say it was at a Harvard Business Review when she met Jack Welch and the rest is history. Usually when I'm introduced, people just skip right over that. They say she was an editor at Harvard Business Review. Next she was an author at blah, blah, blah. And they skip that part that actually was while I was at the Harvard Business Review that I met Jack and I was fired. I'll just put that right out there. And I was fired with the words, which were I should have had to sort of tattooed on me, that say, you will never work again. And so I am proud to be here working again to talk to you about my book, 10-10-10. And what we'll do today, I'll just talk a few minutes about the idea. I'm not going to presume that any of you have read the book at this point, although I hope you do. And then at you read it? Thanks. And then Jack will be my interrogator, and every time he interviews me or talks to me about the book, he comes up with new questions, so I don't know what he's going to ask me. So I will be surprised along with you about where we go. 10-10-10, despite the fact that it's on the Wall Street Journal business book bestseller list, is actually not about business. It's on the New York Times bestseller list, too, and on its general list, and that's actually, I think, more where it belongs, because not so much about business, although there's chapters about work and career. It's really more about something more amorphous, which is happiness, just happiness and how we get there. And I write from a place of a person who's been on both sides of that, a person who 13 years ago when this idea first came to me was a person who had credentials and had a great education but was eluded in her attempts to find some kind of center. And so there I was in February of 1996 with four children under the age of seven and a job as a senior editor at the Harvard Business Review, hoping to be the editor. And I was invited to give a speech in Hawaii to a group of 1,500 insurance executives. This was a gigantic achievement. I felt like, wow, somebody's going to pay to hear what I had to say. It was huge. Plus, felt like a lot of money. So off I went. But because I was going to crack the work-life balance code, because I was going to be the first woman to have it all at the same time, I decided on a brilliant scheme. I was going to bring my two of my oldest children with me. I was going to bring the 6-year-old and 5-year-old. And as I said to the client, you won't even notice my children are here. They're like little adults. And as I said to the children, mommy's going to do a little work. You won't even notice. And, of course, setting myself up for the grand finale of this disastrous event, when as I was giving the keynote address in my bow shirt and power suit with my pointer up in the front of the room like a sea of heads going out, I had warehoused the children in a hula dancing class on the beach, and they made a jailbreak, and they came to hunt me down, and in the far distance I could see their little hula-clad bodies in the back screaming, Mommy, Mommy. And then I was wrapping it up faster and faster, and they just came right in the door. And they came running towards me as I was delivering my grand finale on the history of management. And I thought, something has got to change. Something has got to change. My life is living me. My decisions are making themselves on me, and I'm not living in any way, maturely or proactively or deliberately or all those things you're supposed to be living by the time you're 30-something years old. And I thought, well, I can't undo the past, but I certainly can try to get a grasp on the future. Well, how was I going to do that? Well, the vague idea that floated into my mind was 10-10. If I could just wrap my head around the consequences of every decision in 10 minutes, that's like the immediate future, right, directionally, and 10 years, the far distant future, and I could sort of factor into that my values, like what I really wanted to do with my life and what I stood for, what kind of mom I wanted to be, what kind of employee I wanted to be, what kind of everything I wanted. If I could bring my values to bear on those 10 and 10, maybe I'd have some sort of operating principle to stop this haphazardness. And my mind wandered over this, and I thought, well, what about that midterm, though, that I'm going to a conference in a few months, I've got a wedding, I'm going to be away for 3 days. And I thought, okay, well, what if I sort of kept in my mind this sort of 10-10-10 scenario? And it seemed like, okay, it seemed like a way. It didn't seem like the answer to my life, but it seemed like a way. But it sort of started to play itself out. I started using it right away. I mean, right after I got back from this disastrous trip from Hawaii, I was going to go home at 6 o'clock. And I told the kids, I'll be home at 6. Don't worry. We'll watch Malcolm in the Middle together. And I'm Mother of the Year. But of course, at 5:30, my boss walked into the cubicle and said to me, I need you to stay till 11 o'clock tonight. We've had a production disaster. See ya. And walked out. And instead of trying to do everything all at once, getting in my car, driving home, making hot dogs in the microwave, running out the door, getting back to the office, I thought, let me just try that 10-10-10 thing. And I thought, in 10 minutes, the kids are going to implode or my boss is going to be very pouty and upset. In 10 months, I can actually make this up to my kids because I have flexibility in my job. I'm an editor. I can work at night. But in 10 months, you know, if I want that performance review to be the one that I need to get the promote, I don't think I can make up this big lack of availability in a crisis in 10 months. And in 10 years, well, in 10 years, my career was going to be where it should be, not based on this one decision. And in 10 years, look, you know, the way I figured it, I had four children. Some of them were going to be in therapy for one reason or other, and this was not going to be the deciding factor. Then I thought about my values. I loved working. I didn't want to apologize for it. I loved my job. I was going to be a full-time working mom. And I also was a mother who happened to believe, take it or leave it, okay, that the kids didn't gain anything by me making them the center of every life experience, that they were going to find out sooner or later the world did not revolve around them. I didn't need to make them feel that way in their growing up years. And so I thought, okay, I can stay here, and I don't have to feel guilty or upset or gut-driven by it. And I called the house, and I had the babysitter put me on the speakerphone, and I walked my kids through my first 10-10-10 decision. There was the beautiful sound of silence. And then my oldest boy, the one in the hula skirt, said, okay, Mom, all right, we'll explain the plot to you in the morning. Have a good time at work. And I was like, oh, you know, gravity. I mean, I had discovered this amazing way of living, and I quickly started to apply it. And, you know, it always didn't break towards work. Sometimes it broke towards the kids, or it broke towards also, you know, there was not always the same answer. But what I had was this new flexible way of making decisions that allowed me to live a life of my own making. Well, one thing led to another. Eventually, I left the Harvard Business Review, and I ended up working for the only institution more powerful than Harvard, which would be Oprah Winfrey. And I wrote a column about this idea because I had at that point been using it for 8 years. And unbelievably, I had an avalanche of emails, responses back from people who started, who were using it as entrepreneurs and using it with elderly parents and using it in all sorts of walks of life. And thus you find me here in front of you today, because these stories eventually led me to start speaking about it and hearing more stories. And I eventually met hundreds of, now probably thousands of people who use 10-10-10 to create a values-driven life, to create lives of their own making in all different ways. And one of the things I've discovered as being on the road is how much people want to live those kind of lives, how they want to live centered lives and are looking for a way, one way to do that. And that is what 10-10-10 is. And so I am so interested in hearing your questions about it, because every time I hear questions, I learn more about the idea. But first, before I hear your questions, I guess we'll hear some questions from Jack, who has his little list. I see his paper in front of him, and we'll go from there. But I look forward to very much hearing from you, and thank you so much for listening.
This is not really a list of questions. Oops. For the first time in many, many years, I am, for the first time in many, many years, I was handed a script when I came in here, and I'm a little nervous when it comes time every 15 minutes for me to read my little script here to show that we're on the radio. I'll ask the first question. I tried one down at Santa Clara today at lunch, and it turned out we didn't have any Manny Ramirez fans in the room down there. And I was going to ask Susie what Manny ought to do with this 10-10, but I thought that was a bomb at lunch.
Yeah, there were no Manny fans.
And we're huge Manny fans. I thought I would go to something different. As I understand it, Meg Whitman is running, or potentially going to run for governor. If you were Meg Whitman 10-10-10-ing it, what would you do?
Okay, well, the first thing you do with 10-10-10 is you do a values excavation where you try to determine, you know, what you want from life, who you are, what you stand for, what you want your legacy to be, what your rank of your priorities are. So let me try to enter into her mind and say that she wants to fix California, improve the world, and leave a legacy of public service. Let's just assume that. Then you need to define the question. And in her case, the question would be, should I run for the governor of California? All right, let's just go through the consequences. In 10 minutes, the upside would be that she would open up a door to winning this position. The downside would be a huge outpouring of money, most of it her own, or having to raise money, loss of her life, any kind of normalcy goes out of your life when you're running. 10 months, same thing. And then in 10 years, the upside would be having had the opportunity to, and perhaps having achieved her goals in fixing California. And the downside would be having lost, having that stellar career, but with a black mark that she ran and didn't make it, even maybe didn't make it by a lot. And having weighed those things, and then really it's hard for me not knowing her true values to make the call about what matters more to her, having had this legacy as a, you know, a really well-known, successful executive or a public servant who had the chance to make a huge change in California.
Okay.
I bet if I had to guess, I bet she's done a version of 10-10-10 because experienced executives, I think, sort of have their own plumber, yeah.
10-10-10. What's the difference between 10-10-10 decisions and gut?
Everything. I mean, I think that I'm not, you know, I've been accused of being a person who hates gut, and it's not true. I don't hate gut. I think gut has got its place. I think gut, sometimes all you have is your gut to go on. In the book, I describe a decision I used my gut on and probably saved my life in Miami. But I think that the problem with gut is gut's a little easy, and that sometimes we go round and around, and finally we just sort of make this random call. It's our gut. And the problem with gut is that sometimes it's pattern recognition at its best. You've been here before. What did you learn? And so at its worst, it's a neurological bias that was baked into our brains on the Savannah Plain. And we're reacting to neurological history of the human experience. So I say do gut. Gut's fine. Listen to your gut. But do a 10-10-10. And if there's a gap, figure out why. I mean, I gut is fine. It's just not enough.
If you talk about values excavation, what does that mean? What would people think about to get a quick values excavation?
Well, unfortunately, it's not quick to know your values. So I started talking about 10-10-10 on the road in 2006. And here's what happened a lot. What happened was I would give my 10-10-10 speech with its slides and its this and that. And afterwards, there would be a line of people who wanted to chat. And I would say full 60% of them said a variation of the same thing. They would say, I love your device. I love the mechanism. I can do the 10-10-10s, but I'm not really sure what you mean by values. I don't really know what my values are. And so I can totally relate to this. I didn't actually have a fine-tuned, subtle, articulated vision of my own values until I was in business school. And I was walking on the quad second year in May, and a classmate bounded up to me, and he said, hey, you coming to the party tonight? And I remember I was, like, holding my books, and I was, like, really sort of witheringly staring at him, and I said, I'm sorry, don't we have an industrial marketing exam tomorrow? And I said, ugh, awful behavior. And he said, come on, Susie, we all have our jobs. You've got a job. I've got a job. Just loosen up, would you? And I said something awful like, some of us still care about our grades. I mean, something just ugly, okay? And he laughed. Before he left, he said the fateful words, you know, Susie, you just don't value fun. And then he left. And I thought, oh, my God, I really don't value fun at all. What do I value? So now, look, I can tell you why I didn't value fun. I was really close to becoming this thing called a Baker Scholar, and I knew that if I got it, I would get both years of my business school paid for. Well, I was paying for myself through business school. It was a lot of money off my back, and I was a person who valued being debt-free. Now, there were people who were going to be Baker Scholars, who were going to become entrepreneurs, and they didn't care about being debt-free as much as I did. But finally, at age 28, I had to say, what do I value and why? So since that time, I've done a lot of thinking about it, met and a lot of people who study values as their life, and I have in the book a values excavation. So you can ask yourself a whole bunch of questions about parenting, work, careers, friendship, and romantic relationships and find out what your values are. But very briefly, there's three values questions which I love, which I think are very defining. And I love them because I've heard such a wide range of answers to them. So for instance, take the values question. Fast forward to your 70th birthday party. Think about your 70th birthday party. Visualize it. What would make you cry from regret? So I've heard to this question, I've heard answers like that I didn't keep my family's company going. I've heard that I wasn't surrounded by my children. I've heard from a person, a man who I did a 10-10-10 with, instant answer to that question, instant answer was, the knowledge that my obituary would not appear on the front page of the New York Times. I said, those are different values calls, right? So then another values question I like is, what do you want people to say about you when you're not in the room? And to that one, I've heard people say that I'm a really tough but fair boss, that I've raised decent kids under very tough circumstances. And my favorite, and I tell the story of this woman in the book, she says, I said to her, you know, what do you want people to say about you when you're not in the room? And she said, I don't give a damn. And she lived her life that way. She had a fabulous life living by that value. She had had an amazing life. And then the values question, you know, what did you love about how your parents raised you and what didn't you love? And the interesting thing about that question is when you ask it and people start describing the values they love of their parents' upbringing of them and what they didn't love, and then you say to them, well, how are you living? And you often find that they are living exactly that way they didn't particularly love. And so you sort of say, well, what is your values choice there? And so I think that values, you can do a lot of work to get a firmer grip on your values. And then really when you start to do your 10-10-10s, they're so informed by that values work. And it really can be, in fact, living by your values, living by your authentic values, most revolutionary act you'll ever commit.
I love that answer, that you don't value fun. You've sure made up for it in the last 8 years.
Oh, that's nice, Jack. In the last 8 years is the operative term is in the last 8 years, Jack.
Now I have my clutch moment.
Okay, go for it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Jack Welch, former CEO of GE, in conversation with my wife, Susie, the author of the new book, 10-10-10. Today we're discussing how to make the best decisions in business and in life.
Very well done.
Do you want to have a round of applause?
Yeah, that's very, very well done.
We got a card here from somebody, a series of cards. One of the cards, it's nice to know, is somebody who reads our column in Business Week.
Yay.
And it says, Jack and Susie, you've given Obama an A for leadership and lesser marks for some of his policies. How do you rate him today? How much more bad economic news is there on the horizon?
Well, it's true. Jack and I wrote a column a few weeks ago. It was actually our most controversial column we've ever written. And we gave Obama a flat A on leadership because we defined leadership as vision, communication, and team building. And we thought on those counts that he has been exemplary, very, very impressive.
We wish he had different policies about those things.
Now, the problem is that our later columns continue to say, but we wish his policies were different and on several different points. But I think, Jack, why don't you answer the question about how much more bad economic news is coming?
Well, I think no one really knows, but I would give you a quick glance that I think we've bottomed out in the economy. I have no idea where the market's going, whether this is just a bear market rally or something real. I don't know whether we'll back off or not. As for policies are concerned, I think short term, the last days of the Bush Treasury with Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner were extremely good. We almost lost the country in September, October, November. It was worse than any of us will ever know. We're in the last days. And they threw money at it. And this administration's continued to support those financial rescue packages. The problem that I have is the Obama economic policy has a 4% GDP growth, as far as the eye can see, through the next decade. And it has a $13 trillion deficit. Now, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, we've never grown 4%. What makes anyone in God's world think that we can grow 4% in a globally competitive world with a society that's deleveraging, with a frugality that's touching every person in this audience and everywhere else? It's going to be tough. And a $13 trillion deficit, if we grow at 2.5%, becomes a $30 trillion deficit. That's three times the gross domestic product. We're done. We're cooked. So we just can't do all these things. Now, as admirable as they all are, we're trying to do everything at once, and we don't have the money to do it with. So we're all going to have to face the piper. It's going to be higher taxes. And with higher taxes, you won't get a high growth rate, so it's a vicious cycle. So I'm not concerned about the short term. I think we're going to get out of this mess. I think we're moving forward. But I am concerned as can be about 2, 3, 4 years out with these mounting deficits. So that's an answer to that one. Okay, so Susie, how do you feel about the automotive industry?
Well, I think that a controlled bankruptcy is the only solution, and I think that the swift moves on GM are a good one. I think that it's mitigated, though, by the fact that it's so hard to talk about this in San Francisco, Jack. I mean, we're sort of more in our people on this in sort of Kansas City and other places. But I think that
they asked us.
I think that it's very concerning.
Don't complain to the questioner.
I'm not. Sorry. It's concerning that the automotive industry is going to have the UAW own more than half of its equity, given the fact that the UAW was one of the reasons that the auto industry is in the stink that it's in right now.
It's insane.
Okay. Not to put too fine a point on it.
It's absolutely insane. And to have them own half of it, and to the worst thing about this thing, and you read about it today, maybe in the journal, we wrote about it last week. Basically the lending laws of the country were thrown out the window.
Yeah.
As lenders tore up the contracts, as the government tore up the contracts and says, the unions have the company, you guys get pennies on the dollar. It's outrageous. The law of the land, that doesn't work.
Well,
and you won't have capital formation without having laws of the land to support that. So I'm totally for the bankruptcy. In fact, we argued for it a year ago.
Yep.
And but the idea that the loss of the land, the lenders get thrown out, the creditors get thrown out, and the union gets the company is, to me, bizarre.
It's very bad for confidence.
What are your views of both the stability and the honesty of banks these days? That's a tough one.
Oh, man.
Go ahead.
Stability, I think they're stabilizing. I think they're stabilizing. Honesty, look, you know, honesty is in very short supply everywhere all the time. In fact, you know, one of the things that we've discovered ever since we wrote Winning is we go out, we talk about candor and how important candor is, and what do we hear back everywhere we go? Well, candor's great. My company doesn't have it. Or candor is too mean to be candid. I mean, one of the things that we do when we're talking about business in general is we ask the audience, okay, how many of you have received a completely candid, transparent performance review in the past year? And usually we get
5%.
5%, yes. And then we say, how many of you have delivered a completely honest, candid performance review in the past year? And, you know, maybe
7.
Right. And so, you know, asking about the stability and the transparency of banks. I mean, banks are big offenders. Jack, what is your take on that?
Well, I think without question, this whole point of candor and openness is critical to business in general. And you really see it now when times are tough. We listen to a lot of nonsense, and I've listened to it over the years, and we've listened to it in the last decade together, about the fact that we did differentiate employees, top 20, middle 70, bottom 10. And people in the audience will always ask us, I'm too kind a manager to ever differentiate like that. So what happens to these managers now when recessions hit? They walk down the hall and they say, Mary, Bill, sorry, you have to go home now. And Mary and Bill look at him and say, why me? And they say, because you weren't very good. And they say, well, I've been here 25 years. Maybe you could have told me in the last 25 years. The cruelty of not letting people know where they stand is outrageous across America. And the idea that I'm too kind and too gentle not to tell my people what's good about them and what's bad about them and to rank them is just, it's not kind, it's cruel. Because you string people along until times get tough and then you act on it. As far as honesty of the banks are concerned, I don't think they were dishonest. I think they had a compensation system that drove bad behavior. If you have a compensation system that says, I'll pay you in an hour if you make money in the next 40 minutes, you're going to behave that way, and your people are going to behave that way. You get what you measure and what you reward. That's how the world works. And this system is wrong. I bought an investment bank when I was with GE. I bought Kidder Peabody. It was the worst move I ever made in my life. Dope of the century making this one. We had a value system, to Susie's value points, that went boundaryless behavior, candor, open to each other. The investment bank had one value system: my bonus, my bonus, my bonus. They get up in the morning, and it's all about bonus. It's all about pay. You get this, and that's what you'll end up getting in this thing. And that's what happened here with these mortgages. Everybody's guilty, though. The mortgage originator, the lender who fraudulently filled out the forms, the borrower, I mean. Everybody all along the chain. But in the end, the investment bankers, who were paid enormous sums without a long-term compensation plan or a clawback provision. So
this actually reminds me of one conversation we had earlier today, talking about candor in organizations. And one of the problems with candor in organizations is you are not just in how you evaluate people, but just general candor. You're often punished for it. And one time when I was running HBR, I had an incredibly talented woman who worked for me. She'd worked for 8 years at HBR, and she produced fantastic content. On her third child, she came to me and she said, "I'd like to work at home on Fridays." And I knew that she would continue to produce at a very high level. She was a terrific person. And I said, okay, you can work from home on Fridays, you know, same expectation. She said, absolutely. Otherwise, I can't work here. And I said, got it. Totally understand. And so I told the staff, Regina's going to be starting to work from home on Fridays. 2 days later, a new employee came to me. He was just out of college. His performance was like C- at that point. We didn't even know if we were going to keep him. And he comes to me, closes the door of my office, and he says, "I'd like to work at home on Fridays." And I said, "Really? Why?" And he said, "I'd like to perfect my yoga practice." And I thought, oh, now I like yoga. I like it a lot, okay? But it was not a reason not to be working on Fridays, in my opinion. So I said to him, "You know, you can't work at home on Fridays for your yoga." And he said, "So you're telling me that you value Regina's life choices more than you value my life choices?" And I uttered the honest answer, yes. And I was killed by HR. I mean, I was brought upstairs. I was told you cannot make value judgments on your employee. So, you know, that is, you know, I was in my own company, not rewarded for candor. Anyway, he self-destructed about 6 months later.
The Harvard Business Group has sponsored some of this tonight, so you better be
careful. Oh, I'm sorry. In general, I love Harvard very much. I do.
But I think, though, and we followed that up this noon time with a terrific conversation with a lot of women in the crowd. We had we didn't have a radio show, so we had questions from the audience, and we had a lot of back and forth. And the facts are there's no such thing as work-life balance. It's the worst expression ever invented. There are work-life choices, and you make these choices, and every choice has a consequence. And some people would say, "I want to work at home." Great. And if you're good, you'll be rewarded and you'll have a nice career at home. But when the promotion comes, your lack of face time is going to kill you. And you have to face that reality because you made a choice. And we had a terrific discussion with a number of women in the audience, basically who all agreed with that point, but had to come to it through hard knocks of trying to have a telecommuting, part-time at home and other things, and recognizing that when the promotion comes, the people that have been in the trenches with the boss are going to get the promotion. And the people that have had choices, that very good choices, there's nothing wrong with these choices, they're just not going to drive your career if you choose not to be available. That's what's going to happen. And unfortunately, we can't get a conversation going with format, but it will... What advice do you have for college grads in this economy? Question here.
With college grads, I would give the same advice now in this terrible, uncertain, awful economy as I would give in any time, which is that you're going to be told all the things you should do. You know, we all know that movie, The Graduate, where they tell them to go into plastics. I mean, the thing is, you can waste a good 10, 15, or even 20 years doing what other people want you to do, your parents, or go into biotech. I mean, every time we have a family vacation, my kids ask me about biotech. I say, biotech is for kids who like biology or technology, and you don't like either, so I don't think it's a way to go. You know, and they just hear all the kids at school talking about biotech. And so I would say if you find work that in some way touches you and turns your crank and has meaning to you, and you are working with people that you like and you can be yourself with, right? If you've got to be phony and put on a persona, then forget it, because in 10 years you're going to want to rip that persona off and you'll have wasted 10 years faking it. And there's just no such thing as a happy, phony life. So find work that is meaning. Now, that having been said, we just wrote a column about this. These are terribly tough times. You're not going to get your dream job. Your dream job is a longer way off, coming out of college or MBA or any kind of graduate school now. So you may have to settle the first time around, second time around. But if you settle, my advice would be settle and love it. Settle and don't be resentful or pouty. Settle and over-deliver. Give it everything. And when the economy picks up, you'll be much better positioned to catapult and closer towards the work that you want to do.
And never be a victim. That is the worst game in town. And people all over the place come to work finding out the boss is the problem, the company's the problem, this is the problem. That's a losing strategy. Never let you slap yourself if you start to think of yourself as a victim. Take charge of your own life. Control your own destiny and never let yourself be a victim. I got one here that I'd like to answer.
Please, please.
How can a company that's laying off people continue to motivate employees that are still remaining? By communicating, by being transparent, by explaining the rationale for what's happening. Openly to everyone, by having a performance system that made it clear who was a winner and who was more vulnerable. That's how. You always have to be, and explain to people, I'm doing this because I want to take us there. And here's what's in it for you, and here's what's in it for the company. Over-communicate. There's never been a moment in business history like the last 6 months, at least in our business history, where communications weren't the most critical thing in the world. And what have many managers done? Sucked their thumb and gone under the desk. And that's the worst possible thing they can do. Because they're afraid, if I talk to so-and-so, I may have to lay him off next week. And that's terrible. And we've got 11 private equity companies that we work with, and from Hertz to U.S. Food Service, and all we do is pound our executives about communicating, letting everybody know what's happening, why we're doing this, why we're doing that. And if you can't explain why you're doing it, you shouldn't be doing it. And that is so fundamental to managing today. You could get away in good times with lots of things. You didn't have to communicate too much. You could fake the appraisals. You could do lots of things. You can't do it in bad times. HR is a perfect example. HR is a function that is too often picnics and birthdays, rather than leadership development, management, et cetera. Well, HR is nice in good times, but it defines you in bad times. How you treat employees, how you let them go, how you talk to them. All these things are so critical in times like this. And we've heard, tell some of the crazy stories about the guy with the who came in and they brought the Yelp placement for him in.
Oh, yeah, we just got a letter from somebody. I mean, these are times where there's a lot of layoffs, and we just got a letter, a very touching letter from somebody we knew who he was told he was going to be laid off, and the boss tells him, you're going to be laid off. The next thing he knows, I mean, that's as long as the conversation goes. They walk him down the hall. He sees an outplacement officer. He's never laid eyes on this woman before, and she starts talking to him about the logistics. We're going to do this. It's going to be that. And like 5 minutes into it, she goes, are you okay? I'll call you later tonight to see how you are. And he says to her, I have never laid eyes on you before in my life. I have a dog, I have friends, and you don't need to call me tonight. And his wish was, he said later, I wish they'd just given me a tray full of crockery for me to like just crash against the wall rather than this sort of phony thing. And so this was a case where HR did not do the hard thing, which is when you lay somebody off, it's horrible. We've all done it. The manager has to actually have the conversation. You can't outsource that. You don't outsource hiring them. You have to really give the dignity of letting people go with true conversation from the manager.
How can we bolster public education when there seems to be such tough times now? Well, you can start by doing one thing, getting rid of the unions. The teachers' union is the bane of all employee of all kids and students. It's not it, it is just so wrong. It's all about the teachers, not about the kids. And as a result, there's no excellence. There's no differentiation. The reward systems are out of whack. All these big, thick studies on education, they ought to start with, let's talk about decertifying the union that is getting in the way of a meritocracy in schools.
Jack, why don't you just for 2 seconds explain how you came to this? Because you are so radical on it. It comes from when 5 years ago, Joel Klein, the head of the New York City Public Schools, approached Jack and asked him to run the Leadership Academy for Principals. And I saw in the course of 1 year, Jack go from being sort of, not that he could ever be lukewarm on anything, but from, I mean, okay, so, you know, relatively lukewarm, to red, fiery hot on this because of your experience.
Well, I spent 3 years working with young principals in New York State, in New York City. We got a way to get them certified. You know, there's all kinds of rules for certification as principals without waiting until they were 40 to become a principal. And we had these graduations where we had 100. You were at them.
Yep.
We would have them on weekends up there and teaching them how to manage a school, how to do all this. And they were so turned on. 90% minorities. The graduations were Mayor Bloomberg, myself, Joel Klein. They're giving out the diplomas, the families out there, thrilled for the people. Then we'd have a six-month reunion later with these energized, excited principals that we spent countless hours, nights, weekends with them, back bitter, disillusioned, because the union wouldn't let them do this, wouldn't let them do that, wouldn't let them do this, wouldn't let them fire offenders for all kinds of offenses. We had to let the teachers be alone who did these stuff. So I have seen firsthand, I'm not giving you some theory, I've seen firsthand what the teachers' union does to protect mediocrity, to not punish bad behavior, and all these things. So I'm a strong advocate of stop studying it, stop spending years with big, thick, another education report, and clean up the management of the system. Now I've got to, back to my job
Jack,
again.
Read.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program.
So good.
I'm Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, in conversation with my wife Susie, the author of a new book, 10-10-10, number 5, just yesterday on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you all for listening to that, and I will go on to some more questions. That's unions again. I won't go there. You all know how we feel. A lot of G questions. I'll try and answer them later. I want to get one to you. How do you incorporate time management planning into 10-10-10? Do you plan your schedule with a weekly, monthly task list? How many life goals are manageable to schedule?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. You know, people like to ask how you actually implement 10-10-10, and I would say that I've seen people implement it in every different way. I mean, some people just 10-10-10, really big decisions, and they just sort of put aside some time to do it. Other people have life goals, sort of Stephen Covey, like life goals written down. I've seen people do it on paper. I've seen people do it in partnership with spouses or friends. And I think that time management is just really value stuff, right? If you know your values, then you can start thinking about what you're going to spend time on and not. And so I think that it's a very natural outgrowth. Time management is an outgrowth of starting to live your life by your values. And you can actually, there's no hard and fast rule, I guess, is where I'm going. It is as flexible as you want it to be. People have used it in every different way.
Jack, any decision that in hindsight you wish it applied to 10-10-10? Probably a million of them, mostly the bad ones. But I would say I've seen something really. My daughter here is in the front row, and it's always easier to talk about this when my children aren't here than it is when they're here. But I have had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, and Susie has the same. And in my case, very often emotion would come into my dealing with the kids. I want to do this. No, you can't. I'm going to do this. Why are you doing that? And there'd be a conversation that would, why you talk to me like that? Why are you doing this? And so there'd be a conversation about how we were behaving with each other rather than about the issue. I've seen her for a decade now deal with her kids from little to now a sophomore at Stanford, the oldest, with talking about the issue and then 10-10-10-ing it together. And the emotion comes out of the problem. The emotion disappears. You might pick one.
I was saying, a life coach contacted me the other day. Life coaches love 10-10-10. It's one of their tools, and it's had a great acceptability by life coaches. And one of them said to me, she calls it the great diffuser, so that when they have families come in, families that are in crisis, instead of revisiting personalities and past hurts, they use it as a process. It's a discipline, a process to move forward. And, I mean, I can think of I've had my issues and my moments with my kids. I mean, I wish they were here to sort of tell the other side of the story, but since they're not, I can say that, you know, there are many times where the conversation or the debate has devolved into us talking about how I'm talking to them, or, you know, me saying, why must you always be this way? And there was one not too long ago, where my daughter Sophia was a pretty good tennis player. I really, really, really was self-actualizing through her tennis playing, to be honest. And I could tell she was not liking it anymore, but I had spent a lot of hours on her tennis, a lot of time caring about that tennis. And one day she came to me in the kitchen, and I knew when I looked at her face, this was the tennis conversation I've been dreading, and she said to me, I'm quitting tennis. This is right before she's about to apply to college. And I said to her, no, 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 like 1,000 times no, every way you can say no. And then I should have known what trouble I was in, because the next thing out of her mouth was, that's fine, Mom. Let's just 10-10-10 it. And I thought, I am cooked. And I was cooked, because she had a very logical, she had thought about the decision. She thought about its consequences in 10 minutes, 10 months, and 10 years. She had a little speech about her values prepared, and she just delivered it to me on a plate. And I said, and my sort of final moment was something like, but in 10 years, you won't, if you give up tennis, you won't be able to play with me anymore. And she said, Mom, I beat you so pathetically now with your wimpy, awful serve. You're so much worse than I am. You don't want to play with me in 10 years. You should be hoping that I quit. And she had me, and she was right. I was living through her, and I needed to be put in my place. And so it was a great diffuser. We did talk about the issue. So I think, Jack, just to circle back to the question, what you're saying is parenting is where you would have seen as application.
Well, although on the road, this is our last stop on a 2.5-week tour, and we have audiences that were 1,500, and we have audiences that were 40. And the biggest thing I've seen come out of this thing, though it's not so hard, is a lot of relationship challenges. People facing into the lives they're leading in relationships and coming up in the line with these stories of relationships are just, it's been wild. It's been an incredible experience, and hopefully it's been worthwhile and useful to people in dealing with this. In Kansas City, we had an incredible series of scenes with people each getting up in the audience, with 750 people in the audience, each telling their story. And the emotion in the room was almost like a revival meeting. It was wild.
I mean, after the third woman said, I've decided you've given me the courage to leave my husband, I said to Jack, there's going to be a new group, Spouses Against 10-10-10. I mean, it's just...
Either that or forum.
I know. Not exactly my purpose, but whatever.
In making 10-10-10 decisions, Susie, to what degree should they be intellectual and what degree emotional?
You know, our decisions are already emotional enough, typically. And so 10-10-10 is to reinstate or to restore some kind of system and intellectual approach to them. I think that, you know, each of us has a different way of making decisions. Some of us are too logical, intellectual, and some of us are too emotional. But 10-10-10 is a way to at least be proactive in your decision-making. So if you know where your deficit or surplus is, you can factor that in. In general, the worst decisions we make are sort of seat-of-the-pant, emotional, impulsive decisions, and 10-10-10 is supposed to counteract that. But by all means, if your decisions are sort of Dr. Spock-like in their coolness, you can use 10-10-10 to say, but where are my values in this? Where are my emotions in this? That's why I like, especially when couples or families are using it, to do it as a group, because we can help each other bring what we need to the decision-making. Why don't you answer the GE questions that are there?
Well, let's do this one next.
Okay.
What would you advise to make a 62-year-old CFO who got laid off and is not ready to retire, what would you tell him to do? He is overqualified for most of the companies he's been interviewed with. Well, if I were this CEO, I would take that last line and throw it out. I would say, I'm ready to do anything. I'm excited about the challenge, at least while I'm interviewing. I'd never interview with the view that I'm overqualified. I would interview with enthusiasm, with excitement, with passion, should you want to contribute. And I'd be as vibrant as I possibly do. I wouldn't think of myself as 62. I'd think of myself as 40. I'd think of myself, this is an exciting job. Go for it. And you want it more than anything you've ever seen in your life. If you went with some laid back, oh, Jesus, I'm well qualified. I'm very smart. I've had bigger jobs in my life. You're going to get your butt booted out of there so fast, you won't know what hit you. So the advice is get excited about any job, at any age, at any level, and go for it with everything you've got. Passion is an enormous evaluator. We always use this when we hire people and we talk to people. Four E's and a P. One E is energy. The second E is energize. Energize all those around you. The third E is execute. Get it done. And the fourth E is edge. Be able to say yeah, yes, or no. And wrap that whole 4E thing in a big P called passion, which means you care more, you give more, you're after it more. And that's what the 62-year-old has to do, and that's what a 21-year-old graduating from college has to do if they want to get the job that they want.
Can I add one thought to that? If this is a situation where financial security is not the driving force. So, I mean, let's just say you have some savings. Let me just add one thing to that. We've often seen, and I've had personal experience with this, if you take a job that feels like you can't do it, that's unbelievably hard, it can be incredibly energizing. And I'm thinking a few years back, I was asked to be the chairwoman of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. And the charge was to raise $41 million for the homeless in Boston in 2 years is what I had. And I said to Jack, I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't even know if I can make a case for people to give money to the homeless. It is a very hard thing. You know, people will tell me they did it to themselves. I have never raised that much money before. And then finally I thought, wow, I really can't do this. That's exactly why I should try to do it. And it was like actually the job where I learned the most, met the most great people, changed the most. And so I think if financial issues are not the issue on this one, taking a job that's totally out of your comfort zone is a way to restart yourself.
How do you apply 10-10-10 when several of your values have similar 10-10-10 outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, that people say, I mean, I've heard this many times, but I value my work and family the same amount. Or I value my parents and my marriage the same amount. I mean, I've heard, but the thing is that you can't actually do a 10-10-10 if you're not willing to face into the hard, hard, you know, decisions about sometimes you can't have it all at the same time. When you're saying it's all equal, then you're saying I can have all of it at the same time, and you can't. And you have to, at a certain point, make a judgment call about the rank ordering. That's very hard. That's why it's a revolutionary, radical act. And in fact, there's a story in the book exactly to this point where there was a woman, Nancy Russo, in New Jersey. She wrote me after my article appeared in Oprah magazine, and she was a hospital administrator. She was running quite a large hospital chain, all the administrative functions, and she was on her third marriage, young marriage, divorced, second marriage, widowed, and then a very happy, very, very happy third marriage, raising a teenage son. And after the mother had lived at home with her and Carl, and after 6 years, the mother was diagnosed with a form of Alzheimer's. And for the next 8 years, she and her husband took care of the mother at home. And what happened? Work started going right down the drain, and the marriage started to fall apart. And she was losing it all because as she was taking care of her mother, finally they put the mother into assisted living because they thought they just couldn't take care of her at home anymore. She was getting very ill. And what did Nancy do? To be a good daughter, every day after work, she'd leave work at 5:30, which was too early for her job, but she would do this, drive to the nursing home, stay till 8:30 with her mother, and then drive home. And she was driving home at night thinking, well, my marriage is going to end because Carl loved her, but the marriage was gone. and she thought she was losing it all, but her mind was like in this closed loop thinking. The only solution, because she valued her work, her family, and her mother, was to do what she was doing, and her mind was going round and round. I'm doing what you would do if you valued these three things equally. And one night as she was leaving the nursing home, a nurse saw her crying and handed her the Oprah article and said, "You've got to look at this." And she read it in the car. And she went home, gave it to Carl, and they later very poignantly described to me how they sat on the couch holding hands, both like this, and they 10-10-10 together. And in 10 minutes, she was fighting to say, "I can't let my mother down. Mom will be so disappointed." And in 10 months, Carl said, "Nancy, we can have other people come in." And she was very resistant to giving that peace, the equal balancing of everything. She could just keep it like this. And then finally, they looked at 10 years. And Carl told me later, he thought that it was over. He thought she was going to look at him and she was going to say, I can't let my mom down. And if it means the marriage has got to go, which is what he was saying, then the marriage has got to go. And there was this like silence. And she said, "Carl, when pushed to the wall, I love the marriage. And I think I can't give the marriage up." And she cut back. I mean, this gigantic decision to her to actually do this rank ordering. She stopped seeing her mom 5 days a week, went down to 3 days a week, brought other relatives in, and saved the marriage. Saved the marriage. They're very happy today. It's been 2 years in the past. So sometimes you have to make that decision. You can't have them all equal all the time, or you get yourself in this everyone's happy but me place.
Do you each think we're heading down a path to socialism, as some critics suggest?
Jack?
Well, at times like this, and I've been through enough of them with Jimmy Carter in 76, the Republican Party was dead forever, and then Ronald Reagan, the Democrats were dead forever, and then Bill Clinton. And we go through these periodically. We go through, after every election, there are consequences. And the consequences of this one are you're getting Barack Obama's done nothing other than what he said he was going to do. So he won the election. He's making the calls he said he was going to make. Now, there are obviously some ominous signs. When half of the population pays no taxes, it's going to be tax-free. It's going to be very hard to make a change here now if things aren't going that well. And that's an ominous trend when the tax laws get changed to the point that half the people don't pay. But in general, I think if this crowd misbehaves, overreaches like every crowd that wins does, they overreach, they do all the same things, they'll be thrown out. And they'll be thrown out in 4 years or 8 years. And we'll go back to one of the great things about this country, we get ourselves generally to the center. We get there from one swing to another, but we generally end up in the center. And so I'm optimistic that we will end up there again. I don't by any means buy into the fact that the game is over, we're going to be socialized, we're going to be like France and everything else. No. We're going to have a period of time where the people that elected this party will get what they want. And if it's right, they'll stay in power. And if it's not right, the country wakes up and reacts. And so I'm totally okay with it. I think that's the way it has to be. And our system works pretty well. Susie is a journalist. And me having run a media company, forget me, you're the journalist. What do you think of the demise of newspapers?
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, I think I have two thoughts about it. I started in newspapers. In the book, I write a lot about my years as a reporter at the Miami Herald, the greatest professional years of my life. I arrived in Miami. I was 21 years old. And unbeknownst to me, when I was hired, what had happened was Knight Ridder had a shoot down with the unions. And when I came into the newsroom, it was just a bunch of college journalists because they had cleaned out the house. So what happened was, 21 years old, Miami's in the midst of riots and boat lifts, and we got to cover it all. And it was a great learning experience. I love newspapers. Jack and I start every day by reading 5 newspapers. The problem is that content was started to be given away for free on the internet around 10 years ago, and it undermined the newspapers. And I think it's too bad, but if people read newspapers more, newspapers would survive. And the problem is people like us in this room love newspapers, but our children don't. My kids get all their news on the internet, and they get it for free. So what will happen, my theory is in 10 years, people will be paying for content on, like we will all be paying for New York Times and Wall Street Journal online. But there's going to be a big mess before then. I think a lot of cities will lose their newspapers, like Boston.
I doubt it. I doubt that we can ever go back to charging for content. Mm. I think that the pendulum has swung. The world thinks information is free and plentiful. And I think we're going to have to find other models to devise systems that will, subscription-type models in some way, that will change the game. But the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are going to have a tough time, because what's their content versus what's the world's content? That's where we're sort of stuck right now. But that's just a different effort.
Yeah.
A couple of questions on GE and what's going to happen to GE and all that. Look, I retired 8 years ago. I've never been back to the office one day, not never one day. I left, turned the page, and went on to another life. I think the company is being tagged with a big financial services across their forehead. Even though they made $8 billion in financial services last year, they're thrown in the lump with all the other ones, and they've been beaten up for it. They made decisions that I might not have made, and yet they made decisions that I might have made worse. So the idea that I was the savior is not the answer to this one. The answer to this one is a dynamic time is in place. I think they're going to come out of this stronger than ever, though, because every other industrial finance company has gone belly up. And as a result of that, they're going to come out of the game with a playing field with no competition. So it should be extremely attractive if they hang tough in there. But as far as me being the savior and the right idea, I'm no better than the next guy on that, and life goes on. So that's all I can say about that. I talked about motivation. It seems to me that today's overworked business environment is designed in a way that breaks up families. Would you agree?
There are so many forces that break up families. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of stress just in the world that we live in. But I think more than anything, the thing that breaks up families is lack of candor and lack of transparency, lack of authenticity. And, you know, there's families that break up, and then there's marriages that break up. And I would say that one of the things about working on 10-10-10 is having people come to me or talk to me about their problems at those moments. And what I always hear is that people are not talking about their values. Even husbands and wives, who you would think would have this conversation about what they care about, they fight about whatever is in the room at the time, instead of saying, look, this is how I want to live. I value fun much more than you do. I value adventure. I value financial security. And they're not having those conversations. That having been said, these are really, really complicated times, and the zeitgeist makes it very complicated about how you raise children, for instance. There's so many, cautionaries on TV. You can read about it in magazines. This is the right way. This is the wrong way. And what that leaves you in is just wanting and needing to know what is your way and living by your way, instead of constantly having your ear to the ground on the right and wrong way. So sympathetically, yes, I think these are hard times to have a family. So many different messages coming at you.
Susan, the last question, it's time in the program to come to the last question. And does 10-10-10 help with effectiveness only, or does it trigger a focus on self-awareness and values?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, look, what 10-10-10 helps with is happiness and joy. And I don't want to sound self-absorbed or narcissistic that way, because my true belief is that when you are happy, you spread it. Joyful people don't keep it inside. They spread it, and sort of like it's like a pebble in a pond. When you're happy, the people close to you are happy, and it goes out from there. And so what 10-10-10 does is it does help with efficiency. I have a very efficient life, I think. But I think it helps more with values, authenticity, and then ultimately the outcome of that is having a centered life and a happy life with the ultimate goal of spreading that happiness.
Well, Suze, thanks for sharing your 10-10-10 thoughts with us in this. And thanks to the audience for your rapt attention.
Yeah.
Appreciate it very much.